sister of Moses, the leader of the people of Israel, as they came out from captivity in Egypt. We looked at Sarah, the wife of Abraham, the father of the nation. Big, high-profile. Others who are less well-known. There was Abigail. Do you remember her? The beautiful and intelligent woman who helped David avoid making a big mistake. Or the Shunammite woman. We didn't even know her name. But the common thread for all of these ladies was that they were used by God to further his purposes. They were blessed by God, and they were a blessing to others. And today we're looking at the last in the series, a real beauty queen, a lady called Esther, who found herself in the right place at the right time and was instrumental in saving an entire nation. Whenever I come back to the book of Esther and read it again, which isn't always all that often, but when I do, I often think, gosh, this would make a brilliant film. This would be a really great film. And it turns out I'm half right. They did make a film, but apparently it wasn't great. And there's a still from it. That is Esther, apparently. Clearly it's an actress, as you know. I don't know how familiar you are with the story of Esther, so we're going to whiz through the highlights. And then see how this little story of Esther answers some really big questions about life. So let's start at the beginning of chapter 1. Good place to start. I was going to ask someone to read, but then there's quite a lot of strange names. So, this is what happened during the time of Xerxes. The Xerxes, who ruled over 127 provinces, stretching from India to Kush. At that time, King Xerxes ruled from his royal throne in the citadel of Susa. And in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his nobles and officials. The military leaders of Persia and Media, the princes and the nobles of the provinces were all present. So the setting is Persia, modern day Iran. The king is this guy called Xerxes, and we're going to call him the king from now on. But he was a powerful man, King X, the big X. He ruled, we know, from 486 to 465 BC over a vast empire that stretched from India to Egypt. The thinking is, when he gathered all these people, as we read in the beginning of the chapter there, he gathered all his rulers and leaders together to plan an attack on Greece. I mean, he's thinking big, right? So he got them all together to work on this plan. Once the planning was done, which they spent 6 months doing, he threw a party, and a party that lasted 7 days. The wine flowed freely. It says, by the king's command, each guest was allowed to drink in his own way. The king had instructed the wine stewards to serve each man what he wished. So it was quite a party. At the end of those 7 days, the king decided he wanted Queen Vashti, his queen, to come out so he could show her off to his drunken mates. For some reason, she didn't want to do that. And she refused. So the king sacked her. But then he had a problem. He's now got no queen. So his personal attendants came up with a plan. Why don't we hold a beauty contest for all the eligible young ladies, and you can choose the new queen? And again, for some reason, it says this advice appealed to the king. Can't think why. But it was all set in motion. And it's at this point we meet the young lady called Esther. She's grown up in the care of her cousin, who's a Jew called Mordecai, who was captured by King Nebuchadnezzar when the Babylonians attacked and destroyed Jerusalem. So Mordecai has brought Esther up as his daughter since her parents had died. Seems like Mordecai was probably an official in the palace. He'd got into government circles, so he knew what was going on. And when he heard about this competition for a new queen, he gets Esther on the list of eligibles. Because it says in chapter 2, verse 7, this girl, known as Esther, was lovely in form and features. So, she goes to the palace, she enters the courts of the king, and is groomed, and groomed is the wrong word in the current society. She's given all the beauty treatments, special food, she's looked after, and wins the favour of everybody. And it says in chapter 2, verse 17, the king was attracted to Esther more than to all the other women, and she won his favour and approval. So he set a royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. And the king gave a great banquet, Esther's banquet, for all his nobles and officials. They have a lot of banquets and parties, don't they? And he proclaimed a holiday throughout the provinces, and distributed gifts with royal liberality. Everything's good. But then we come across someone else, a much less savoury character, and his name was Haman. He was in with the king. He had the king's ear. He got promoted and promoted and promoted till he got to the point where everybody, apart from the king, was supposed to kneel before him and honour him and say, "Oh, you're great." And he had a problem because Mordecai, Esther's cousin, refused to do that. And that made Haman mad. So he decides he's going to get even. He's going to get rid of Mordecai. But when he does some digging, he finds out that Mordecai is a Jew. So he's not just going to get revenge on Mordecai. He is going to get revenge by destroying all Jews throughout the kingdom. So he hatches a plan and he takes it to the king. And without telling the king who they are, these people, and crucially without knowing that Esther was Jewish, he persuades the king to sign the orders that on a given day, the people can destroy, kill and annihilate, those are the words, all Jews in the kingdom. So long before Hitler, Haman had planned to devastate what was left of the Jewish nation. Things aren't looking so good. Mordecai hears of this plan and he gets in touch with Esther and says, "You've got to do something. Go to the king, beg for mercy." But there's a problem. Even Esther, the queen, can't just wander into the king's presence unless she's summoned. The law is that if you do so, it means death, unless the king points his scepter at you, which means you're accepted. So Esther agrees to do it, goes into the king's presence, and after a few heart-stopping seconds, the king holds out the scepter. So she's safe. And the king says, "Oh, you look nice, Esther. You can have anything you want. What would you like?" Esther says, "I'd like you and Haman to come to a banquet," which they do. Haman thinks, "I'm in here. I get to have a meal with the queen and king." And the king says again, "What would you like, Esther?" Esther says, "I'd like you to come to another banquet tomorrow." So they do. And after the food and everything's gone well, the king again says, "Look, Esther, what would you like?" Esther says, "I'd like you to spare my life. Spare the life of my people. Because someone is trying to kill us all." The king wants to know who this is. Who is planning this terrible act? And Esther says, "It's this vile Haman." And that's her words that are described. The king blows his top. He orders Haman to be hanged on the gallows, incidentally, that Haman had been preparing for Mordecai. And a new order is issued to allow the Jews to defend themselves if anyone attacks them. And it all ends well. Though, not for Haman. There's a few more plot twists. We haven't got time to go over all of them this morning. Maybe if you read the book again for yourself or go to a home group study this week, you'll catch more of it. But it's a brilliant story. It's full of colourful characters. There's intrigue. There's cliffhangers. Twists you didn't expect. But is it anything more than a nice story with a happy ending? Well, because we've made it part of our series and it's part of the Bible, clearly I believe the answer is yes, it is more than just a story. So what can we learn from Esther? As I mentioned before, I think her story asks and answers some really big questions like these. Where is God? In a world where God often seems absent, is he still there? What does true beauty look like? We live in an image-obsessed culture. How do you tell what really makes someone a beautiful person? And third question, they're getting harder. Why am I here? What am I meant to be doing? How can I please God? So the first question then, is that going to do something? I'm not sure. Yes! It's not really that visible, is it? Where is God? When you look around the world, we constantly see situations and images and behaviours which make you shudder, which are horrible. When you look back through history, you find some appalling things happened. And there's no apparent sign of God being involved or even present. Even David, as we read in the psalm at the start of our service, "Have you forgotten me, God? Are you looking away?" But the book of Esther has got something to say to us. If you sit down and you read the whole book of Esther, you realise it's unique amongst all the other books in the Bible. There is no mention of God, none whatsoever. There's nothing about prayer, there's no worship, there's no sacrifices, nothing. Which is quite surprising, isn't it, for a 10-chapter book. It's quite, you know, it's a reasonable size, it's in the Bible, and it doesn't mention God. We do see Mordecai refusing to bow down to Haman. Maybe there's echoes of Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego who refused to worship Nebuchadnezzar's statue about 100 years before this. Maybe there's a close to a mention of it at the end of chapter 4 when Esther has agreed to go to the king and she asks Mordecai to gather all the Jews in the city together to fast for 3 days before she goes into the throne room. Seems likely they would have gathered and they would have prayed as well as fasting. But it doesn't say so. Why is God left out? It seems that the writer is trying to make a point. He's deliberately refraining from mentioning God to emphasise to the readers that actually God is still at work, even though you don't see it. God is arranging all these coincidences at just the right time. God is invisibly active. He's working through Mordecai, having this position of authority in the palace, being able to hear what's going on. He's working through Esther in her situation as the queen. He's using these people to bring about the deliverance of the Jewish nation from the evil that was planned by Haman. When you get home, read through the whole book. See how many coincidences just happen to occur that mean it comes out as it does. Whether God's mentioned or not, he is at work. And God's still at work today in the affairs of nations and of individuals. God raises up leaders, whether you like them or not. God inspires scientists to be able to develop vaccines. God inspires individuals and musicians and artists to create songs, to capture beauty in paintings or photographs. God moves people to act or speak out, prompting us to make phone calls to that lonely person, to send flowers or a card, to be a listening ear or a willing companion, whatever it is. God's at work through us. And that's quite amazing, isn't it? God uses people like us for his purposes. The book of Esther helps us to realise that that is what's going on. Whether God is explicitly mentioned or not, he is at work. So where is God? Well, we can be thankful that he hasn't left the world free running. God's still on the throne of heaven. God's actively involved. God's working his purposes out. Even when disasters strike, even when life seems to be falling apart and hope is gone, God is still there. And Paul, in the New Testament, 700 years later than Esther, I think, wrote, "We know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose." So where is God? God's living and active in our world today. What does true beauty look like? We've got a lot of sayings that we use sometimes. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Beauty is only skin deep. Beauty fades, dumb is forever. That one's courtesy of Judge Judy, by the way. Show you the quality of research I give you. What is true beauty? What would you say? Esther won the king's beauty contest. In no small measure because of her looks, I'm sure. But there's lots more to Esther than just that. She seems to have had a beautiful character as well. In chapter 2, verse 20, we find that she continued to follow Mordecai's instructions as she had done when he was bringing her up. She listened to guidance and acted on it. When she got taken into the palace and joined the harem, it says that she was put in the care of Hegai. And it says she won his favour by her attitude. Chapter 2, verse 15. She listened carefully to his advice and followed it and won the favour of everyone who saw her. And then as we read in chapter 2, verse 17, she won the favour and approval of the king. Again, yes, her looks played a part in that. But her attitude and her demeanour did too, I'm sure. And as the rest of the story unfolds, we see someone who considers what she's going to say how she's going to act. That whole thing with all the invitations to dinner, I don't think it's a random act. I think she'd carefully considered what would be the best way to bring the king to see what he was about to do by allowing this genocide to take place. She showed great care in planning it, great discretion. Proverbs 11:22 says, "A beautiful woman who shows no discretion is like a gold ring in a pig's snout." I used to like that when I was a teenager. I thought it was very funny. But anyway, it's true, isn't it? Physical beauty may be skin deep, but true beauty manifests itself in your behaviour, as exemplified by Esther here. And again, the New Testament writers take that same thought forward. In 1 Peter 3, Peter says to the ladies, "Your beauty should not come from outward adornment, such as elaborate hairstyles or the wearing of gold jewellery or fine clothes. Rather, it should be that of your inner self, the unfading beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is of great worth in God's sight. For this is the way the holy women of the past, who put their hope in God, used to adorn themselves." He was addressing the women. It probably applies to men as well. So I haven't got my elaborate hairstyle today. But he isn't saying you shouldn't have an elaborate hairstyle. He isn't saying you shouldn't have nice clothes or jewellery. But that's not what makes you beautiful. Tempted not to break into the One Direction song. So, good on you, Esther. Your true beauty was evidenced by the way you lived, by the way you carried yourself, and you're consistent in all she did. That's what true beauty looks like. And the final question we find in Esther, why am I here? Not as in, why am I at church this morning listening to Chris? But what should I be doing? What difference can I make? And the answer to that depends on how willing you are to be used by God. Whether you're willing to put your own needs and comfort behind that of others, or whether you're prepared to step out in faith regardless of the possible consequences. Esther chose courage over comfort. I think that's a phrase we heard with one of our earlier women in the Old Testament. It's been said that courage isn't the absence of fear, rather it's choosing to do the right thing despite being afraid. When Mordecai urged her to go to the king and plead for the lives of the Jews, she points out the risks. Undeniably, it was unwise to presume on the good nature of the king. The account tells us several times where he's flown off the handle in rage. He showed questionable judgment, putting so much trust in Haman. He wasn't troubled about executing people. So Esther's going, "You do know what this could cost me." Mordecai came back with this statement, chapter 4, verse 12. When Esther's words were reported to Mordecai, he sent back this answer. "Do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place." In other words, God's purposes will be done. "But you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this." Mordecai says to Esther, "Look, God will deliver his people, whether through you or someone else if you choose not to be part of it. But recognize that God has put you there right now. I think this is your time, Esther. This is why you are the queen." That's massive. Where are you today? What situation are you facing? Has God put you there right now for a purpose? What is it? What can you do that is the task just for you today? Dear Auntie Edna, who used to be here at church many years ago, used to remind us of a song from, maybe it's from her youth, I don't know. "There's a task for Jesus ready at your hand. 'Tis a task the Master just for you has planned." And that's just for you. The person stood next to you can't do what you can do. They're not in the same situation. And the thing you've got to do today may not be the same thing as it was last year or last week. It may not be relevant at all by next year. But right now, God has put you in a situation. What's the reason that you've come to your current position? Last summer, as in 2020, the summer that never was because of lockdown, and we were on Zoom, we followed a series called Frontline Sundays, which developed this thought a little bit, that wherever you are, whatever you're doing, that is your front line in working for God. That's what God wants you to do right now. And I came across the video and I thought, actually, yeah, that's relevant. So we're going to just, hopefully, see the video at this point.
Hours a day,
6 days a week,
whenever I'm needed,
every Saturday morning,
I spend my time
in a place that matters to God,
with people that matter to God,
my front line,
in the stresses,
successes,
problem solving,
tantrum resolving,
laughter,
teamwork,
jokes,
tears,
boredom,
tension,
cups of coffee,
cans of coke.
God is working with me.
He helps me see what he sees.
Put here by God.
He knows the day ahead.
This place is rich with possibilities.
This is my front line.
So whether you're a plumber, a football coach, working in office, or taking care of grandchildren, whatever it is, God's put you there for a purpose. That's your front line to work for him and serve him. Esther's front line was in the palace of the king. The reason she was there was because it was part of God's master plan. Much to her surprise, I'm sure, she found herself in a position where she was able to influence the course of history of the Jewish people, and ultimately, therefore, of the world. Esther acted where she was and with what she could do. She trusted her future to God, and I think we can justifiably say she stepped out in faith. What is God asking you to do today? I can't answer that for you. Where has God put you for such a time as this? How are you going to respond? Esther shows us that God is actively at work. He's arranging all kinds of small coincidences to bring about his will and purposes. God chooses to work even through us. And Esther reminds us that we should look for true beauty of spirit or of character, a consistent life. Not only look for, but strive to produce that, because it's far more valuable and lasting than just our appearance. But above all, may God find us willing to serve him and be part of moving his kingdom forward wherever he has placed us today, to his glory. Amen.